Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh,
you're in the madhouse now.
The following episode may contain explicit language. Listener discretion is advised.
Today's show is sponsored by Blue Durango Iced Tea and the Atlanta Coffee Supply Group, Atlanta's premier full-service distributor of hand-roasted coffee and premium iced tea, brewing equipment and supplies for the hospitality and food service industry. You've been hearing me talk about Lakehouse Coffee for weeks now in these sponsored reads, and while I'm drinking it during the show, they also make Blue Durango Iced Tea. Did you listen to the July 17th episode I did with Jonathan Silverman? We drank that iced tea. It was awesome. As I said before, you might already be enjoying these products. Do you go to places like Wahoo, South City Kitchen, Gusto, and Dantana's? Dude, Gusto, I just interviewed that guy. That's gonna be great. If you're a proprietor in the restaurant or food service industry, reach out to them right now. Tell them I send you. Say, hey, I want to start carrying Lakehouse Coffee and Blue Durango Iced Tea because they're great products and it's a local freaking brand. Tell them the Atlanta Podcast sent you. Hey, and if you're just a regular person, you can order this stuff. My friend Steven ordered a bunch of coffee from the website. Go to lakehousecoffee.com and check it out and learn more about them. That's lakehousecoffee.com. Podcast. I am your host, Mappy Davis. Not sure if you heard. Oh yeah, award-winning Critics Pick 2018 Creative Loafing Best Podcast. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's 2018. It's almost over, and I just learned about the rap air horn sound, which we were using, which Chris was using on the live show. Two episodes back. I'm just learning it. I'm very excited. Thank you, Creative Loafing. It's nice to win things, right? We all love to win stuff. So yay me, yay Creative Loafing. Let's hit the air horn one more time. Yeah! Okay, there we go. It's enough of that. If you've been leaving podcast reviews, I appreciate those. Do we have any new ones? All right, we haven't had one since June 6th, 2018. From SCZO Gator, and I know who that is. So I think it's time you left a review, guys. Hop in the old iTunes and leave a review. I always say I'd rather you tell a friend, which I would, but also leave a review. It means a lot. Want to give a shout out to the one, the only Baron Press. Came by to see me yesterday on a run, recognized me in the West End. If you see me, don't be afraid to say hello, even if it's the middle of the street and you see a sweaty guy running. That's me. Let's get today's show, shall we? I don't think I have much else to share about what's happening in the ATL. On today's program, Chris Hall from Local 3. Now, top of my head, I can't remember who made our introduction. I'm sure I will at some point, but we had a great chat. I really enjoyed it. I was noshing while we spoke, which isn't always polite to do, so I hope you don't hear me too much chewing, but it was delicious. So yeah, two food podcasts in a row. Not usually what we do, but hey, that's how it turned out. Last week, The Grindhouse. Go back and listen to that beaut. Alrighty, Chris Hall and I, away we go.
Can we do an okra and a popcorn? Thanks, brother.
Very first question.
Yeah.
What is this? We're in the middle of a fucking office building.
Yeah, this is the strangest. So we took this over in 2010. This was a restaurant called Joel. It was built by a Dutch billionaire who wanted like Michelin-starred chefs when he came over to survey his empire in America.
Right.
And he came over here and built this. So it's this strange kind of oasis in the middle of this office. There's a big condo, super expensive condos. Athletes, a lot of movie and music people live next door. That's the Blank Foundation offices up on the top of the hill. So that's Mr. Blank's dojo. And yeah, it's this little wild enclave in the middle of Buckhead, and we're stuck right in it.
And I'm looking at...
You're looking at Northside Parkway.
Looking at Northside Parkway.
Yeah, so which, right off 75, right? I mean, we're 200 yards from 75.
Yeah, so once upon a... So are you from here?
Yeah, I grew up right... Part of the reason we called the restaurant Local 3 is I really am a local. I grew up about less than a mile from here. All right,
so do you remember when OK Cafe was the only 24-hour spot in Atlanta?
In Atlanta.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So that's what this exit always means to me. Don't ask me why, but, like, no matter what, every time I get off here, I think about, like, oh, shit, remember we used to go to OK Cafe? Like that, yeah, that, like, Waffle House was it.
Yeah, there was nothing else.
No late night
what's
food.
So weird is, like, telling people how to get to your restaurant by identifying a competitor's restaurant. Like it's kind of weird, man. It's like people are like, where do I go? I'm like, you know where OK Cafe is? We're right there.
Right.
And they're like, oh, yeah.
But everybody then you're inside it. This goddamn office building. So yeah, I'm saying the food here must be really good because otherwise, like, even parking, I parked and then it's like, no, here's the parking for the place. You should have stayed in your car
longer. Yeah, it's completely bizarre. It is a destination restaurant, right? Like, no one sees us. We have no street presence. When we did this, a lot of our peers were like, y'all
you're
are
an idiot.
Fucking crazy.
Right.
There's no way this is going to work. That's one of the lucky things about growing up in this area. I knew there was a hole in the marketplace that we could fill, and I knew if we did it right, that this market would support us. I mean, that's the whole idea, is we really are a local restaurant. I mean, yeah, we get tourist traffic, but this restaurant's supported by our neighborhood.
So people walk down from here?
People walk down from all the buildings around here. People drive. I mean, there's so many folks within 2 miles of here with homes, and... You know, they're not going to wait in line at Houston's. Canoe and Blue Ridge are probably maybe a little more formal than
right.
we are.
Right.
And they don't want to go and eat burritos or anything like that. So there was a hole for an independent restaurant, like, at that tier where they could get interesting food that's reasonably priced but that's cool. And that's where we fit in the whole matrix.
All right. So where did you go to high school?
I went to high school at Macaulay in Chattanooga.
Okay.
I discovered beer at a young age and... Went to school up there, so that was the best thing that ever happened to me, but I needed some structure as a young youth. So the moral of the story is, don't burn down a large portion of national forest land that a bottle rocket wore as a young child.
Okay. Which national forest land?
Well, I was up in Tennessee, up by Swan.
What were you doing up there, though?
Well, we lived up there for a while, and I was up there with some friends just kind of camping, and we went to South Pittsburgh, which is the firework capital of America, and bought a bunch of fireworks and decided we'd have a little bottle rocket war, and things kind of went awry, and things caught on fire, and then there are planes flying over dropping that retardant stuff, and
right.
not a really good.
I don't think you can say retardant anymore.
Yeah, probably not. It's probably too bad.
So you went. You ended up. You had to go to military school.
Well, it wasn't military. It was the right decision. Yeah, I wasn't forced to go to school. I just needed some structure, and Macaulay was a great place. It's still one of my favorite places.
And then did you go to college?
And then I went to a small school in Philadelphia called Haverford, and kind of, I was supposed to. I think I was supposed to. Follow the path, or at least I thought at the time. I was, you know, you go to boarding school, you go to college, you spend 2 or 3 years working, you go to grad school somewhere. I was thinking law school. You know, you do that, you get on partner track somewhere, you get married, you have 2.3 kids, you join the country club, you have a white picket fence,
and
you go to church every Sunday. Yeah, I looked at that and went, yeah, no fucking way. And so after my junior year, I didn't tell my parents, which is not advised, and just dropped out of college and started cooking. And
I think that is the way to do it. I think the way is to not tell your parents. Unless they're paying the bills. They're paying the bills.
They were paying the bills.
Then you gotta let
them. Not real cool.
You gotta let them know.
But they've been super supportive.
So you're a fucking dyed-in-the-wool kitchen guy. You're one of those guys
You know, I started at the Pizza Hut wearing a brown polyester uniform on Collier Road. It's now Das Barbecue. So
I worked at
that
Pizza
was,
Hut.
Yeah. See, all great things start at Pizza Hut. Maybe not. That's a good way to start a lot of good drunken stories. This time at Pizza Hut.
Well, it's funny because, like, looking back on it, like, very quickly, like, they let me, like, open the store on the weekends, and, like, and in the summer, and like I thought it was kind of cool, but like looking back on it, like of course they did. As soon as you get some fucking willing 17-year-old, yeah, you don't want to get up in the fucking morning.
Yeah, it's all yours. So you learn a lot. I mean, there's so many principles that they've seen.
You want to quickly describe?
We just got a couple of little summer things. So truffle parmesan popcorn, which a lot of our guests refer to as crack. It's just something that we've always had on the menu. And then some crispy summer okra, a little comeback sauce. So,
woo!
Comeback sauce is kind of like the, I don't know, it's the ubiquitous condiment of Mississippi. So it's got a little heat to it.
I like that though.
Yeah, it's got a little punch to it, and it really sets the okra off.
Now, Delia's has comeback sauce. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, same idea. I mean, it's a pretty universal Southern.
I didn't know that. I thought like they come up with that because they have so many cool names for things.
No, yeah, they do have a lot of cool names. But that's a real, as I understand it, a real Mississippi thing.
Do you know her?
So, we've met. My wife was a roller girl for a long time. And so we met through Derby, and they helped sponsor Derby and stuff.
She's one of the coolest people.
Yeah, done so much cool stuff.
I've ever talked to. Like, super cool lady.
Yeah. I mean, this business attracts some of the most fun people you can ever meet, and interesting people, which is probably why I got in it. I mean, we get to kind of throw our own dinner party every night. We don't get to invite everybody. They kind of invite themselves, which is good. But it's always fun seeing who comes in and getting to interact with folks.
Well, to me, the most interesting part is that, you know, any passion that you make a living at can still be work, right?
Yeah.
I do not want to get up and do X today.
Right.
Deal with vendors, deal with some shitty staff member, or I don't want to fucking cook today, right?
Sure.
That's the part that I think is like, how does one sustain that over time?
I think for me, there's it's about the creativity part of it. I think I need a creative expression, and that's the part I enjoy the most. So you kind of think of it as a trade-off, right? I have to do the stuff and deal with some certain things I don't want to deal with in order to have the sort of honey, the cool part. I'm fortunate. I've got two business partners, one of whom's a chef, one of whom is not. But like having Ryan, who handles a lot of our business stuff, and I mean bigger picture business stuff, like I have no interest in bidding out health insurance for 160 people. Like, I would literally rather stick my arm in a whirring blender than do that. And so having the fact that he's really good at it, he enjoys doing that, is awesome because it allows me to focus on the stuff that I like doing, which is, you know, cooking and dealing with guest experience and making sure what we're doing is awesome and up to date and current, and we're doing it well.
What does up to date mean to you?
I think trends change, and I think you can stick with some classics, which is great, but I also think the word relevance has a great significance to me. I want to be relevant, not in a sense of, you know, like on the front page of the paper, but relevant in the community, relevant to the people that come here. And so I want us to serve things and do things that are classic and timeless. But also, I want to be ever-changing so that we don't get passed by. I want to be reinventing ourselves constantly. And so that's something that we work at all the time.
I am really digging the sauce, dude.
I'll give you the recipe. Seriously. Yeah, all our recipes,
my wife can be able to recreate it. I will be able to.
Yeah, no, it's easy. Yeah, it's got a little punch to it. And
what's the punch that I'm tasting now?
So it's a little horseradish and a little sambal. Sambal, Thai chili sauce.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of a ubiquitous condiment for us. I love it. It's got that like garlic chili thing going on.
And how many other spots do you have?
So we have this, and we have Muss and Turner's in Smyrna, so which has Eleanor's, which is a speakeasy attached to it. And so that's what we got going.
And the speakeasy, that's a very like now thing, right?
Yeah, we did it, 6 years ago, 7 years ago. So it was just something that we had a chance to take the space next to us. And we didn't really have a bar at Muss and Turner's at that point. We had a little bar that sat like 8 people. And we were like, hey, we could do something cool and serve some cool drinks. And we all live in that neighborhood, and there was no place to go and have a really great drink. I mean, you couldn't even get a great vodka tonic, let alone, you know, some sort of well thought through cocktail. And so that's how that started, because we were just like, hey, we want to do something for ourselves and for the neighborhood.
We're living in this very, I don't know the word for it, I'll call it hipster times, right? Alcohol pairings with food, being very conscious of the whole farm-to-table thing. I don't think that can stick around forever just because tastes do change. Or do you think, hey, people now know how to appreciate good food, so they're going to continue to appreciate good food? It's not just, I spend $1 at McDonald's and I spend $100 at a nice steak joint, which is kind of what we grew up with, right?
You know, I think that's going to be the interesting thing is there's been sort of a democratization of food. It's more accessible. Good food is more accessible than it's ever been. It's expensive, but people are willing to pay for it. I think, you know, it's interesting because many places perceive that if something gets big, it's necessarily bad.
Right.
So if you go to Woodford Reserve and Chris Morris, who's their master distiller, is there, they produce a lot of whiskey. But they still do it the exact same way as when they were producing very little whiskey. There's no computer. They use handwritten logs for all his batches of whiskey and everything. So it's just done on a bigger scale, which will be interesting to see how that plays. I mean, I think for a while, as the internet has gotten bigger and people's access to knowledge has gotten better, you're going to start to see things sort of go even more micro-local. So instead of eating Mexican food, you're going to go eat Oaxacan food, or you're going to go eat food from Sinaloa, right? It won't be Italian food. You won't have... It will be the food of Emilia Romagna, or the food of Rome or Trastevere or something like that. It will be very interesting to see that. I think that's probably the next trend, as things go hyper, hyper local and get even smaller.
Do you get a lot of press?
No, not in comparison to many places. But that's not really our goal. I mean, we've said for a long time that, you know, our goal is that when people leave here, they have a giant smile on their face. And so it's not something that we... I mean, I love it when we get it. I'm not going to turn it down. But it's not something I'm seeking out. It works perfectly. You can put the popcorn in the comeback sauce. The cool thing is, in Mississippi, they use comeback sauce as like salad dressing. They use it as a condiment. They use it on almost anything. So yeah, I mean, we don't... No, I'm certainly not one of those guys of my peers, many of whom are friends, that's done a ton of TV or gotten a ton of recognition. We're here doing what we do, you know, and that's great. We're happy about that.
So, I assume we're talking about like Kevin Gillespie or what's his name with the hair?
I mean, we can take Kevin's a great friend of mine.
Kevin was the very first guest I met on the show.
Kevin's awesome. Kevin's one of my favorite people.
But I'm trying to think the other guy that's gotten the most press from down here, and I can't believe I'm forgetting his name.
I mean, Richard Blaze got a lot of press when he was here, right? Now he's in San Diego. Eli's gotten a lot of press because stuff. I mean, you know, Kevin Rappin gets a great deal of press, and deservedly so. Kevin's a great chef, a great friend, and has run amazing restaurants for a long period of time. So I think it's a lot of it is what you're out for. I know a lot of people that get great press who are amazing chefs, and I know a lot of people that are amazing chefs that don't get a ton of press. So I think...
You've never had like a PR department like, hey, get us some more stuff?
No, we've never really engaged in that. You know, I've got a face made for podcasts, maybe. Certainly a body made for podcasts, so... It's not that we don't try. It's just not a focus of what we do. Our focus is here in our restaurants every day, trying to make sure our staff and our guests are having the best experience they can possibly have. Anything that comes from that is great, but I'm not a guy to be on Twitter. I need a better filter. Twitter scares me because I end up getting myself in trouble. So, I got off a lot of social media. I'll do Instagram because it's pictures and relatively not political. So I just think generally I'll speak out when I feel it's important, but as a whole, politics and religion and the restaurant business, that's a volatile mix.
Can I take a quick note to say that of these two, I would take the fried okra. You said this is the crack. This to me is amazing.
I love the fried okra. A lot of people think okra is weird because they're like, oh, it's slimy. And
if you're not from here, you haven't eaten a lot. I've eaten my share of fried okra, and I'm saying that like this is pretty good. Like this seems like it made. I don't know. This like isn't filling to me. Like I want to eat
the okra will fill you.
Yeah. Right.
I'm with you. I mean, we're fortunate. We get great okra that's grown here locally. And I think the weird thing about okra right now is most of it that people eat probably isn't, it's probably a frozen product, right? That's pre-breaded and then dropped in a fryer, whereas this is just okra that's cut, and then we bread it when you order it, and we fry it when you order it, and that's what you get. So it's one of those things that if you do it a la minute when it's ordered, it just has that kind of fresh taste that's awesome.
Right. Yeah, like I said, I grew up with pretty bland food, and it wasn't until I married my wife who gave me a much better appreciation for things. And now, like, I'm certainly not a snob, but I definitely, like, if I'm going to go out and spend money, it better be really fucking good.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, which is an interesting, conundrum or things in the restaurant business. I mean, you know, people have certain expectations, and, you know, it's hard. I think it's really hard for a lot of ethnic restaurants to... because they're pigeonholed. If I'm not going to pay $6 for a taco, but the ingredients that you're using might be $6 ingredients, and it might be a $6 taco, but people just won't pay that, and so it's really difficult. They get pigeonholed into, I can only do X because I can only charge X, and that's not fair to them, right? I mean, it's an interesting conundrum that some friends face of, you know, using really great ingredients. Now, it's going to cost more money, and it might be a $5 taco. As long as it tastes like a $10 taco, you're it, right?
Right.
It's all about, you know, under-promise, over-deliver.
Well, I know that, like I said, like my wife and I, if we're going to do a date night, right, we've got the sitter, and we're going to spend the money, you better knock our socks off. And rarely are our socks knocked off. Usually, these are my three kind of things, right? Like appetizer, main, like dessert, it can be hit or miss, I think, pretty much anywhere, but... It's like appetizer, main, and ambiance. And usually they'll get one of those three really right. Like, wow, that knocked our socks off. But then it's like, oh, the app was kind of shitty. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or one of those three. And so to get all three and, like, you felt like we left the house, we spent this money, it was worth it.
So for a date night like that, are you risk tolerant or risk averse? Like, are you going to go back to someplace that you know is going to deliver? Are you going to take a risk and be like, I'm going to go somewhere I've never been, take the chance that it's... Might not be good, but I'd rather take a chance.
It's so rare now that we're pretty risk averse. I think earlier we would take, I think when we first moved to Georgia, we only had one kid, we were bouncing around a lot more. But now, we'll go out for cheap meals because we just want to get out. So we just go out for tacos.
Right, which I think is great. I mean,
right. we'll go to El Mariachi just to get some tacos. Which it's fine. Is
great. I mean, that's the funny thing is like there's this perception as a chef that like, I mean, people ask, where do we eat the most? We eat at small ethnic restaurants where we can go buzz in. We don't have a lot of plans. We're not, like, and we're just going to run to El Pollo Dorado and get a whole roast of chicken and some sides, or we're going to go get tacos at El Rey del Taco, or we're going to go get, you know, Chinese at Tasty China or Northern China Eatery. Like, it's not, we're primarily, at least my wife and I, going to smaller ethnic places. And just popping in like you talked
about. So we went to Gamble the other day, actually. Funny you mentioned that. So we were like, let's get some sushi. We didn't know what we were going to do for date night, which is, again, what we kind of come to now. Like, you don't even remember to make the reservation.
Right. She's like, funny.
So I just watched Hero Dreams of Sushi, right? So
which is awesome.
Sushi on the mind. Let's get some sushi. So the one place we tried to go to, we get there, and they like laughed at us. Like, dude, you need a reservation.
Hayakawa?
I think whatever those popular place up there is.
Yes, yeah, Hayakawa.
Right?
Yeah. It's unbelievably great.
So then we went to just sort of the next one, and it was really disappointing. Like, extremely average sushi. And average sushi is like... You know,
yeah, average sushi is not... Average sushi is almost scary.
It's like average... I can't think of a good example. But
like, no, disappointing. It's disappointing. You definitely should make a reservation at Hayakawa, though. It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's great. Really, really great.
So when you say, what's the difference between, you talk about staying relevant versus chasing trends? I'm making air quotes for our podcast listeners.
Yeah, you know, I think it's just, I think every great restaurant, at least in my experience, has an identity. I have a problem with restaurants that sort of will morph to change with the times. You need to morph a little, right? But like Local 3, when I concepted this, when my partners and I concepted this, I'm like, I'm a bourbon guy. I don't want to be everything to everybody. I don't want to have 15 vodkas. It's vodka. It's a tasteless, flavorless alcohol. Nothing wrong with vodka. I mean, it's just...
Tell that to a Russian, damn it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I get it can be made from... But it really is. And we decided, like, we're going to be the best damn bourbon bar we can be. And that, so, you know, and that was before bourbon was big. That was 8 years ago when people were still kind of like, you know, when you could actually walk into liquor stores and get Weller. And now you can't. And so I think you just have to have a very strong identity and sense of who you are, as opposed to just trying to morph with the times, because you're always going to be behind. And I think there are certain things that work and don't work in different places. I mean, if you're sitting around looking at New York and San Francisco for all your inspiration, or London, like, some of that might work here. It might work here in 3 years. It might not work here right now. It might never work here. So instead of being derivative, settle on what you want and what you think is kind of your ethos and what you want to be, and grab an identity and live that identity. I mean, that's very much what we've done here, you know? There's a lot of cool pop culture stuff, and there's whiskey, and the food is meant to be fun and accessible, but definitely a twist on normal stuff you might have.
Well, this might be out of your purview, because you talked about what you like and don't like to do, but, like, do you know, like, how well you search for, like, bourbon bar or restaurant, bourbon restaurant? Like, do you know that stuff?
It's funny. We were just talking to someone about SEO and, like, if we're popping up, because we... That's the one area, actually, if I'm brutally honest, I get kind of cheesed off about, is we have a really amazing bourbon selection. I mean, we have over 300 bourbons here. Like, and I'm not talking about shit that comes in a plastic bottle. I'm talking about real great bourbons, like some super rare stuff, a lot of super rare stuff that's really reasonably priced. And I see these, you know, things of, this is the best bourbon bar in Atlanta, and they've got 40 bourbons. And I'm like, you're fucking kidding me, man. That's all shit I can go buy at a liquor store. I got the last 8 Parker's Heritage releases. Why don't we taste through those? And then we can talk about, like, some badass whiskey, right? I mean, like, it's... I think that's an area that we should probably be better on, which is why we're looking at it. But I think we have a really kick-ass bourbon program, and it's something I'm really
proud
of.
Well, it's one thing for someone to write an article. Those can go 100 different ways. Those could be... You know, if you're friends with the guy at the Journal or Creative Loafing or whatever, he might throw you a bone. But I'm talking about just flat out, like,
yeah.
I
mean, my biggest deal is, for the last 6 years, the Bourbon Review has named us one of the top 100 bourbon bars in the country.
Well, that's good.
Like, that's pretty cool.
But if I type it in here, now, it does it a lot by location, so it's probably going to pop you up right away because I'm here. But it might do two different things. It might, so if I just put bourbon bars, Atlanta.
See what it pops up.
All right, here we go. Cross your fingers. Okay, so the first one is a paid one called The Southern Gentleman. Are you familiar with them?
Yeah, they're in Buckhead.
We like them, or we don't like them?
Oh, we love them.
Okay, they pay for it. It's the very first thing that comes up. Then, interestingly enough, okay, now you do need to do some help, because I'm fucking here, and it's not popping up, because it
right.
should be.
See, that's why we just engage somebody to help us.
So, geographically, it shows me The Southern Gentleman, Pot of Beans, bourbon, beer, and burgers. That sounds like a place that's going to be here today, gone tomorrow.
I have no idea.
Southern Art and Bourbon Bar.
That's over at the Intercon.
Public Draft House.
I think that's East Elling or Midtown.
Then it's got the 15 best whiskey bars in Atlanta on Eater. Are you on there?
I would hope so. I think so.
Wrench and Barrel, Little Ale Steak, Southern Art and Bourbon Bar, Local 3 Kitchen Bar. All right, you definitely need some help. Now, here's the thing. Much like cheesy restaurants, there are plenty of people that like know what they're doing and don't know what they're doing with the whole marketing and SEO thing.
Oh yeah.
So did you hire a company? Did you hire a gal? Either way is fine.
No, we have someone that does it, that we got referred, who does it for large corporate.
Okay, good. Entities. All right, so then you're probably in good shape.
Like, they work with Fortune 500 companies.
Right, because a lot of people, they're just like, I don't know how to fucking do this, here you go, and they go through three or four companies that didn't do shit for them.
So about 20 minutes into the interview, I realized I was way over my head, because he was using terms that I had.
I know, but that's how they dazzle you. You can't be dazzled by terms.
But then I ran it by my brother, who does stuff like this.
And he said, you're solid?
He said, you're solid.
Right.
So...
because that's, dude, that is the, and obviously it skews younger, so your audience, he might be a slightly older audience or not?
Yeah, no, our audience is definitely, I would say, 35 to 55.
Right, okay, so a little older, but still, like, that, the world we live in is, what do you want to do tonight, right? And then it's open, swipe, pick.
Yeah. Who's got a reservation and it's done, all done through the phone.
Right. So
and never leaves the phone.
Right. So you guys should definitely do better than that.
I'm with it. Trust me. I mean, it's an ever-evolving marketplace for us. I mean, when you look at it, I think there were over 600 restaurants open in Atlanta last year in our class. Like, yeah. Like
bourbon bars.
Not bourbon bars, but like independent... non-chain, like not QSR, but sit-down restaurants. And that's like, that's a lot for a city of our size. So our space in the marketplace is ever more competitive and ever more crowded.
So when does one decide I need to open more of these in other places?
It's funny having that discussion this morning with my partners. You know, these is the interesting question. Are you opening the same thing or are you doing something different? Because, you know, it's the end game is an independent operator with multiple different concepts is much different as someone that can say, hey, I've got 24 sports bars and I'm going to sell them all. Because 24 sports bars, if they do well and you've got a multiplier, private equity will come in and eat. I mean, the whale will come to eat you. That's not what we've chosen to do. That's not what fulfills us, and that's not why we're around. Part of what we do is, you know, open different concepts and things that are different and fulfill us creatively and find a spot in the neighborhood. I mean, we're looking to open neighborhood restaurants that stay around for 15, 20 years and become part of the community.
Can I tell you what we could use over the West End?
Sure.
Anything with food in it. That's where I live.
It's, yeah.
So I live 20 minutes south of here.
Yeah.
And a little more west. And we've got, we've actually got four breweries and a distillery coming. But we are a food desert.
And they'll come. I mean, as soon as those get open and there's a need for food, there will be people that come out there and you'll have much better food and it won't be long. Just because this space, like right here, is so crowded right now. I mean, there's not a lot of space. It's a very interesting real estate market right now in Atlanta, and it will be very interesting to see how the next 18 to 24 months play out in our space, in restaurant space.
So I spent a fair amount of time in the east side of town, and there is another fucking... live, work, play, building, going up. It's, they're everywhere. And I'm like, I fear the, you know, the big, like, half-empty, half-built things coming when, if and when the market crashes, because it's like, where are these people going to come from?
Yeah.
How many people can live in the Beltline?
Right. Yeah. I think this is a very interesting thing. This is probably out of my depth, because I'm certainly not an economist or a city planner or anything.
You're
like
not?
That.
You're not a city, you don't have a degree in planning?
No, I got a degree in nothing, in jackassery. But when you look at this, like, let's just draw a parallel potentially between what happened in the housing market and what's happening here, which is, okay, so Amazon disrupted everything. They fucked it all up, right? Because for a long time, when you built something, you put retail in there, right? And retail drew people in because people shop and that's where they bought things. And so when you built your building or whatever, retail was your anchor. Your strip center, you wanted Hi-Fi Buys and you want Walmart and you want a grocery store, right? They're what retail, what anchors you. Well, retail's dead. Long live Jeff Bezos, right? So, that was said in jest, by the way. I mean, not that
he can hear
anything.
Us.
Not that he probably...
Somebody's Amazon Echo.
Exactly. Not that I have anything against Bezos. I just... So you don't have retail. So now it's experiential stuff, right? So now look at the battery, what the Braves did, right? I mean, what, there are 26 restaurants there? That's a ton of freaking restaurants in a small space. I mean, so when you look at it, you're going, okay, so now they want restaurants and experiential. So there's a lower barrier of entry because they need to get us in there. So you're not going through, you know, there's a lot of money out on the market right now. And so, but those rent deals, you know, where are they? And is there the potential for a bubble? And what happens there?
Well, listen, if we know anything, it's that life is up and down, right?
Right, it's cyclical, right? We're gonna hit some turbulence at some point.
Right. I mean, this is my little canary in the coal mine. I think I've mentioned this on the podcast before, so if I have, forgive me. But I think it was... So everything burst in what was it, like, 08?
Yeah, it was 08, trust me. The first version of this burst, right? We lost a significant amount of capital. We lost all our working capital. We had plans. This restaurant was supposed to be across the street in that building.
Right.
And that building was part of a bank that was seized by the government. And they, when we went, we were like, what about all our money? They kind of laughed and went, that's a you problem. They were like, shit, we're young entrepreneurs and we're out.
You were young then?
We're relatively young. I had more hair than I have now after owning my own business for 9 years.
Well, here's what I was saying, that it wasn't a full, like, 4 years later that I heard ads for, you too can flip houses. Like, those were already back. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like, that shit's already back, which means it's that much, means there's access to that money and people are willing to do it. I was like, we learned nothing.
I
it wasn't 10 years later, it was like 3 or 4.
Yeah, I agree with you.
That to me is like, whoa.
I agree with you.
And we were so close to, like, I don't know, like, complete apocalypse that it's like, is it going to be even worse next time?
I think that's a scary thing to ponder, right? It's a very scary thing to ponder, but it's going to be very interesting. I mean, for us, it's a scary thing because we're a luxury brand. You don't have to go out to eat, especially in the space that we're playing in, right? You can easily stay home, do it for less. Your wife's a great cook. I mean, we are a luxury good, and that's a scary thing contemplate.
Do you have any idea on metrics, though, as far as, like, are you, like, how much of your audience is, like, my wife and I who are making a big deal of it, or people that both make the dinks who could come here 3 times a week?
For Local 3, because of our zip code, this is a pretty affluent area.
Right.
A recession hits everywhere. I mean, where we did so well in 08 was at Muss & Turner's. People found a value in what we were doing. We were at the right price. We were there. So we actually flourished through the recession. It taught us how to tighten our belts, how to be leaner, how to be better business people. And we actually did better through that as people started to realize, hey, there's some real value here and these guys are running a good operation. So it's interesting. But, you know, we know a little bit about our numbers. I mean, but they don't always correlate to, I don't know how they would relate to a recession, other than it would suck for us. I do know that. I can assure you that.
And what zip code are we?
We're in 27. 30327.
Good old 27. I lived in 28 once. Off of Dalrymple. I'm pointing the right way, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Good old
yeah.
Sandy Springs.
Yeah.
But you know, when I left and came back 10 years later, it looked very different. Like there were no brown people when I grew up here. You had white people in the burbs. You had mostly, like, black people in town. There were no Indian people. There were no people from Spanish descent. And then I was in Sandy Springs when I first went back in 05, and I was like, where did these people come from?
Yeah, it's kind of, I mean, I think the best example of that in Atlanta right now is Atlanta United.
Oh, yeah.
I think for a long time we wanted to style ourselves as an international city, and we couldn't figure out how to do it from the Olympics on. It was just kind of this, but I think United has captured that. And when you go to those games and you hear 10 different languages being spoken and you see people of every color and ethnicity and creed, and yet everybody's getting along and rooting for the same team. It, to me, it's a sign that Atlanta's arrived and it's a different city than the one I grew up in. Because we were pretty provincial for a while, and we'd be like, oh shit, we got a big airport, we got Delta, you know, and we're international as hell. Yeah, I mean, that's it, man. And now when you look around, you actually see like real diversity. I mean, you want to go eat Ethiopian cuisine, you can go to Desta. I mean, there's Venezuelan restaurants. I mean, there's legitimate diversity reflected. I mean, could we be more diverse? Yeah, but there's legitimate diversity here now, and it's pretty fucking cool.
Did you try to get a spot in the new stadium?
We spoke with them, and it just wasn't something that fit our business model and what we wanted to do.
Which is? What about it doesn't fit?
Which new stadium, Falcons or Braves?
Well, let's not even speak of the Braves.
So, you know, it's you're banking a lot on X number of events per year.
Right.
It's not, I mean, there's going to be 10 home football games, and you've got the college games and all that, but are you really big enough? And then we're a relative unknown. I mean, Gillespie's a name, right? Kevin, everybody knows Kevin. They know Game Changer. They're like, holy crap, let's go up there. He does a great job with it. And so it was a little more risky for us at the time.
Actually, I think it would make more sense for you guys to be up at the...
Yeah, but we have a restaurant that's a mile and a half from there, so...
You mentioned the Battery, and, like, to me, that's, like, the antithesis of, like, the sporting event experience that I want. I had a very disappointing... I was trying to, like, all right, I'm going to go to a Braves game at the new stadium, and I was like, this is not...
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think the Battery's interesting for me because it's... You know, their goal is, as I understand it, is to transcend the sporting thing and turn it into a destination when there's not games. And I think some of those restaurants do really, really well. And there's some good stuff up there restaurant-wise. Whether they've achieved that, I do know a lot of people that go up there. And I know for a while, like, we had to take a look and go, hey, business isn't, you know, what's happening? There's a blip on our radar screen, and it tied in with them opening. And we've been able to kind of overcome that, and we really had to work to do that. But that's a big thing. I mean, look at what happened to, you know, I was the chef de cuisine when 4th and Swift opened, right? Which is sitting at the back door of Ponce City Market. And everything was great. We were one of a few places down in that area, and we did really well. And Ponce City Market opens, and you just had so many options that they got squeezed out of the game. I mean, it was just impossible for Jay, I think, to compete at the end. I wasn't there at that time. We had already done this. But it was such a great restaurant, and I was so sad to see it go.
Yeah, I honestly don't know how many of you guys stay open, because all you ever read about is this place is gone, and then it seems like you blink and it's another thing. It's like, oh, that was two things ago.
Yeah, exactly. There's iterations.
I was just in the Highlands, and I hadn't been down that one particular strip in a while, and I was like, come on, it's like five new things.
Mm-hmm. Which is going to be interesting to see how long they stay open. I think there's a lot of... That's the one thing a recession does bring about. The good operators find a way to manage their way through it. And the guys that are kind of half in or half out or just have done it for an investment... You know, that's going to be very tough on them. But the guys that are, and the groups that are in their restaurants every day, who are really paying close attention to it, they'll weather the storm, I think, in the long run.
Do you want to die in the kitchen?
No. I do want to, I'm more restaurateur than chef at this point. I mean, I'm still involved, and I'm fortunate to have chefs at our restaurants, and Todd, my partner's a chef, who were really great. I would like to, for my last project, I would like it to be a vanity project where I can be in the kitchen full time and have the restaurant of my dreams. And it's not meant to make a ton of money, it's not meant to lose money, but the imperative is not, hey, we got to hit X as a number. It's, I want it to be pretty small. Like 50 seats, which really economically is very difficult to pull off in these times. But I have a vision for what I want it to be, and and I want to go out that way. I want to go out cooking full time.
Well, you know, Hero Dreams of Sushi, what has he got, like 9 seats?
Yeah, he's got like 9 or 10 seats, and, you know, it takes, what, several years before you do anything but clean rice and all. It's that's so amazing to me because it's such the antithesis of what we see now of the instant gratification. I mean, that's a lot of you know, the frustration of some of us kind of middle-aged, older chefs is people come in and they get out of school or they come in and they have great ideas and they have access to stuff that we never had, right? I couldn't watch Grant Achatz making tureens on YouTube and copy it. I had to, you know, learn from someone to do that. But they're like, oh, I'm ready to do X. And we're like, there's a lot of difference between watching a YouTube video on how to clean turbo and cleaning 700 pounds of turbo. I would, it will be interesting to see how that younger generation of chefs sort of invents themselves and does all that.
Do you watch any television cooking?
No.
But you know who these people are.
Categorically, well, I mean, the folks I'm referencing are kind of more people that I respect but I would actually tell you this is hard. I've never watched an episode of Top Chef. I've never watched an episode of Gordon Ramsay doing anything. Who legitimately was a great cook at one time. I mean, you don't work for the people he worked for. You don't work for Marco Pierre White unless you're really good. But I just don't do... My TV time is very limited, and it's probably focusing around soccer if the TV's...
Right. Well, just to stand up a little bit for Top Chef, which I haven't watched in years, but I did watch it like 5 years ago. My wife and I watched it pretty religiously. That is a very different show than Gordon Ramsay yelling at people. It's one of the reasons why it is good is because they show a little bit of what's going on when they're not in the kitchen, but it's always about that instead of like here's some fake drama.
Yeah, I know for a lot of people, like, it's been an interesting time. I mean, losing Bourdain was really meaningful to a lot of people, and I've read his books, but I hadn't seen No Reservations or Parts Unknown, I guess.
Right. Guy travels the world, eats and drinks a lot.
Yeah, and that had a tremendous effect on a lot of chefs that I know and people I know in the business. I just consume... It's not that I don't consume food media. I do. I just consume it probably over the internet and going direct to sources. And, I mean, there have been so many, like... You know, Google does Google Talks where they have somebody come in and, like, you know... You'll see someone like Eric Repair talk for an hour about food. And I'm much more inclined to do that than I am to watch... I'll watch some of the stuff on Netflix I've seen... But for the most part, I'm just kind of in my own world.
Did you watch Julia Child?
I did watch a little Julia Child. Actually, kind of one of the things that got me into cooking is there was a show on PBS called Great Chefs of the World, where they just went in and like did 30 minutes with these great chefs from all over the world. So they were, and it was the production value was pretty low. But you're talking about, like, some of the real greats, like Freddie Girardet and Alain Ducasse and, like, people that you're like, holy shit, you know, these are like, really, really, really the people that were, you know, at the top of their game changing the food world.
Right.
And so that's the one show that, like, I've always found fascinating just because they would make insane recipes, like, you know, artichoke stuffed squab that no one would ever try at home because no one's ever making pigeon at home, let alone... turning artichokes, turning them into force meat, and stuffing them. But it was probably like mid-80s, late-80s. It was a cool show. I like Justin Wilson, you know, the Cajun guy. He was a Cajun dude. But my favorite chef of all time is the Swedish chef on the Muppets.
That's what you tell people when they ask you your favorite
chef. No, really, like, that's the dude. I mean, think about it. He just shoots holes in donuts and parties down. If you've never seen, there was something, it's on YouTube, you can check it out, but there's the Swedish chef doing Rapper's Delight.
Oh, wow.
Which, that's 2 minutes that'll make you smile, man. I mean, if you don't smile with the Swedish chef doing Rapper's Delight, like,
something wrong with you.
Probably a deep hole in your heart that no one wants to explore.
All right. So we always wrap up with the Atlanta Favorites quiz. Are you ready?
Wow, this could get tough. All right, yeah, I think I'm ready.
It's about your favorite, so there's no wrong answers.
All right.
So first question is, and I ask this to everybody, not just food people, what is your go-to order at the Waffle House?
You know, I'm like a Waffle House junkie, right?
I don't know that,
yeah,
but everybody's got to fit. We'll talk. Good.
You asked my claim to fame. This is like my claim to fame.
That's
but
my
I'll
claim
answer
to fame.
It. I'll answer.
My claim to fame.
I'm the only 3-time winner of the Waffle House SmackDown.
Get out of here.
Where chefs, so it started at Charleston Food and Wine, and they get a bunch of chefs, and they set up two little Waffle Houses on stage.
I think this is
probably why Robbie connected us.
Because I was talking to him about the Waffle House.
So, Wow.
3-time winner.
I'm the only one that's won it twice, let alone, I won it 3 times. I'm retired now. I retired from all Waffle House competitions.
You should. If you win free, go out on top.
So, we just had a great event for the Giving Kitchen, which is a charity I'm deeply involved with, where Kevin Gillespie and I took over the Waffle House on Piedmont.
I did not know this.
And threw down. It was an auction lot Kevin and I did for the Giving Kitchen, and we did 2 seatings of our version of Waffle House food. 5 courses each. So
what was the dollar value? What did I have to pay to get into this thing?
I think tickets were $500 a couple.
Okay.
All went directly to charity.
Right.
And so you got a 2-inch thick T-bone and other insane stuff. Kevin had
their kitchen though, their products.
Yeah, no, our products, their kitchen.
Got it.
Like so we brought like our stuff, our menu, 5 courses to their kitchen. Yvonne Monet DJ. It was insane. It was really, really fun. We're going to do it again next year. My go-to order at the Waffle House, my home store, as they call it, is 424 on Atlanta Road. So shout out to Dean and my friends there. I usually get a cheese omelet and hash brown scattered, smothered, covered in bacon.
So
sometimes throw in an all-star or hash brown bowls are underrated.
So I'm all about the bowl these days.
Yeah.
For years, I was... very standard chicken sandwich plate, scattered smothered cover, right? Or sandwich deliciousness.
Patty melt.
But then I saw that bowl, which is like recent years, and I was like, that's what I want. So I get the bowl and I go heavy on the hot sauce and I just dig in.
Yeah, I'm down with that. So for our charity Waffle House dinner, we did little patty melts. And I shaved fresh black truffles all over our version of patty melts with American cheese.
That's amazing.
Relatively obscene.
Well, the reason I say claim to fame is because like amongst my friends and like on social media, like I'm always in the Waffle House. I've actually cut down, like I've dropped a fair amount of weight in the last couple years because I was doing it too damn much. My gut told me that if I asked people that question, they would have an answer. And I'm telling you that people that have eaten there, you know, 10 times in the last 10 years, people who eat there consistently on the weekends, like, everybody's got their order. Like, it is an absolute Southern question.
Yeah, no.
People always know their order.
Like,
they never have to think about it.
When Gillespie and I were doing the menu, we, like, that's how we started. It was like, what's your order?
Right.
And then we started working off what each of us like to eat at a Waffle House. So,
right.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, at one point I thought I might, you know, everybody's got those like hit every something documentary. I thought that might be my calling, the hit every Waffle House documentary.
I think that would be cool. So.
It would be amazing, but here's the deal. With a wife and 3 kids, I hear which of the kids are out of the house.
Yeah, that's gonna be a labor intensive but awesome undertaking.
Right.
You need an RV and you're just on the road, man.
Right, but like that's like, this is the kind of stuff I like to do. I like to talk to people, I like to make cool content, so like making. Somebody will probably make it by then, but I can maybe still make my own. Like, you know, you hit every Waffle House.
One of my most prized possessions is a Waffle House jukebox.
You have one?
I have a Waffle House jukebox.
And so you have all the Waffle House songs?
I have all the Waffle House songs in the Waffle House.
Do you know that this Sunday they're doing something at the museum?
At the 10th anniversary of the museum is this Sunday.
Are you going to go?
Yeah. You know, I think I might show up. It could happen.
I have gone to a couple of those that they have. I just drive my kids and they
just... The kids love it, right?
Yeah.
I mean... Yeah.
They know. Now, here's the thing. Here's what's so I do a lot of these races on the weekends, and one time I went to Steak and Shake afterwards, and kids eat for free at Steak and Shake on the weekends. So occasionally I cheat on Waffle House if I'm with my son and I go to Steak and Shake.
I understand.
Because it's free.
It's free. It's pretty strong.
Right? Okay. So the next question is, what is your favorite restaurant in Atlanta right now? And again, these are questions I ask everybody. You just have to be.
I'm trying to think. I think Hayakawa is amazing. I think Beach Cracklin' is terrific.
Where's that?
Over off Bolton, barbecue. Brian Furman. They do amazing barbecue. That hash that he has is like crack. I mean, it's unbelievable. Love El Rey del Taco. I'm a Szechuan junkie. So, Tasty China, Masterpiece, Northern China. Those are all. Do I have to pick one?
That's good. You get to pick a lot. I usually let people pick either a breakfast and a dinner or a cheap and an expensive. Like when people say I can't think of one, I usually give them those categories. But you cover plenty. Okay. Complete the sentence. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
I take Marta blank.
To Atlanta United Games.
Okay. Very common answer. To the airport is number one answer, of course.
Yeah. It's unbelievably great for my wife and I. We live in Smyrna, and so you hear a lot, it doesn't go out. We go right off 20, like one exit. We get there, it drops us right at the gate.
Are you Hamilton Holmes?
We get on at Holmes and go right in.
You go right past my house, bro.
It's like so unbelievably great and convenient, and there's always fun people that you meet.
Of course.
You can have a conversation going into the game, coming out of the game. There's always a really great presence of folks that work for Marta, so it's kind of seamless. We tell everybody, like, we took some folks to the game, and they were like, ride Marta? And I'm like, yeah, I'm not sitting in traffic paying $40 for a parking spot and dealing with all that shit.